The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to Happy Horror Time Podcast. I'm Tim Murdoch.
And I'm Matt Emmert. And our special guest today broke into the horror scene after writing the screenplay for Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers. He then went on to direct various films like The Amityville Murders and The Haunting of Sharon Tate, along with the Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Scream series documentaries. His new movie, Ted Bundy, American Boogeyman, has an upcoming video on demand and DVD release date of September 3rd. Please welcome to the podcast, writer, director, producer, and good friend of ours, Daniel Farrens.
I'm almost in tears, guys. That's so beautiful.
Did you like that Oscar-worthy intro, Dan?
I was like, I've done all these things. Like, well, especially the ones that, you know, make people really angry, apparently. But
he loves long walks on the beach, and he boy, does. Can he, like, you know, I'm trying to think of, like, what else
can I stir the pot, apparently. So, thank you, guys. That's really kind.
It's well, thank great, you for great to being be here. Yes. We're really lucky to have you on here. Seriously.
Yes. Aww. And I'm assuming you grew up like Matt and I, and we're huge horror fanatics. How did this obsession with the horror start?
Gosh, oh God. Probably my life. No, no. But seriously, I have to blame my babysitter. Who
Laurie Strode? Sorry.
Well, she's kind of like Laurie Strode, but she was like, I still call, and I'm still friends with her. And I still call her the world's worst babysitter, but the world's worst, but meaning best babysitter. Her name's Kathy. And she, against, you know, all her better judgment and my, you know, powers of persuasion, took me to see Friday the 13th Part 2 on its opening weekend. And I was like, so my mother was out of town for the weekend and left us, my sister and my brother and I, with Kathy, who was like a senior in high school. And we were like 10, 11, 12. My brother was like 5. And so I saw this, you know, cover of Fangoria, and it had Mrs. Voorhees' head in the refrigerator. And I was like, I need to see this movie. So she took us, and it was a matinee. And I remember being the repressed little Catholic child that I was, thinking, I've just made the biggest mistake of my life. I have just invited Satan into my life. And I literally just spent the entire summer with the lights on and unable to walk past dark hallways or dark rooms, thinking Jason was going to jump through any doorway or any window and pop out on me like he did on Amy Steele. So I was utterly and completely traumatized. And then you have to remember, this is 1981, and it was the beginnings of franchises as we now know them. Yeah. So Halloween, the original Halloween, was its first broadcast, you know, television premiere was that fall. So I'd gotten over the trauma of Part 2, Friday the 13th Part 2, and I hadn't seen Part 1, by the way. So Halloween.
So you were wondering Halloween, what that head was in the refrigerator?
Well, oh my God. Well, they did the whole 20-minute flashback, yeah, though. Remember, oh, yeah, the beginning. Right. So you kind of got caught up on, I was like, oh my God. So the original Halloween had its first network airing, you know, in a cut and reshot forms. And, you know, there were others, those additional scenes. But I saw that, and I remember again, and I just remember piling pillows up everywhere around me. And we had this new device that, you know, very few people had then, called a VCR. And I just decided to record this movie. And why I thought I needed to watch this movie again, I don't know. But it was in the early ages of video, home video, where you'd record things and think that was the best thing you've ever seen.
Yeah, I remember.
Anyhow, I had a huge video collection. Huge. Right? I maybe have like 10 now.
Right. Oh,
I don't know. Yeah, I may have four. Well, but anyway, okay. So you recorded the TV
version. So I recorded the TV version of Halloween. And I, you know, went to bed completely freaked out. And the next morning, I had this VHS tape, and I was like, and I talked to my sister, and I was like, you have to watch the rest of that movie. Oh my God. It's like, and then it became like an absolute obsession. And I spent the rest of my junior high and high school career essentially making every kind of like Halloween, Friday the 13th knockoff, you know, student film that you can imagine. So let me tell you, when I ended up cutting forward a lot of years, when I ended up doing a Halloween movie and went to my high school reunion, they were like, yeah.
Of course you did.
So, I mean, like, did you go to a film school or college?
Like a semester.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I just didn't see that as my path at all, you know?
No. And, well, hey, I mean, it hasn't hurt you in the industry. No, I mean, that's amazing. I guess we'll then take us through, like, in terms of how you led into getting the screenwriting job for Halloween 6, because I've heard stories about how you had like this entire notebook with research on the Halloween films and like this incredible pitch prepared for Mustafa Akkad. But can you tell us about that?
Sure. I've told this story like 10,000 times. I'll see if I can try to vary it up a little bit.
Yes, please.
I haven't told anybody else. But so I remember seeing how I was living in Los Angeles after I graduated high school. I basically packed my little car up and drove from Santa Rosa, California, where I'd done part of my, you know, the formative years. And
so you were 18 years old?
17. I hadn't 17? hadn't quite turned 18. I was like a month away from 18.
When you moved to LA, not when you got the job as the screenwriter.
But not too long after that. So anyway, so Halloween 4 had come out. Halloween 5 came out. And I remember seeing Halloween 5 with two close friends of mine who will back me up on this. And we walked out and I said, I'm going to write Halloween 6. Just said it in the lobby of the theater. Wow. And I didn't know how that was going to happen. I had no connections. I had no I didn't know Mustafa. I didn't know anybody. I just declared it almost like to the universe, I guess, and to my friends. And so in those days, there was this thing pre-internet where production companies were listed in this book. It was like $5 at any newsstand called the Hollywood Creative Directory. Wow. And for $5, you'd go to any newsstand, you could buy this thing, and it had every like kind of production company listed in it. And there was, you know, Galaxy International and Trankus International Films, which was Mustafa's company at the time, still Trankus, but I wrote a letter to them. It was more like a to whom it may concern kind of letter. And I kind of pitched myself, and I got a call back right away from a guy named Ramsey Thomas, who had been the producer on 5. And he said, oh, you know, we are looking for writers for Halloween 6. We're going to make it right away. Like, if you like, send in a script, send me something right away. We're talking to writers like right now.
And oh, my God. Quick, yeah. Sorry to interject,
no,
but they didn't care, like, because you said that you hadn't gone to film school, that this you hadn't written a film before. They were just like, send us something.
I mean, I hadn't written anything produced at that time. You know, I'd written several scripts. And so that's kind of what I was pitching, is like I'd written just, you know, some spec scripts, so horror scripts.
Got it.
And so Ramsey said, send me something. I'll read it. You know, just kind of like, yeah, whatever, you know, sure. We're looking at writers. And he was, you know, he kind of opened the door. So I was like, we're in there. You know, as we did in those days, I Xerox copied my script and put it in the mail with lots of stamps and figured that was the end of that. And then, I mean, it was probably maybe a couple weeks later, I guess, that I got another call saying he read it, he really liked it, and he's going to set a meeting for me and Mustafa. And of course, you understand, like, I was 19.
That's
oh my God. You must have, wait, please keep going. But that's, you must have been freaking out.
Well, you know, that absolutely. And of course, I'd like never really pitched anything in my life, you know. So here I am, like, being summoned to the, you know, the principal's office essentially in my mind. So I'm thinking, you know, what do you do in a pitch meeting? So I thought, well, you know, I'll pitch him. I'll bring in, it was almost like to cover my ass. You know, it's like, well, maybe if I really suck at telling the story, I can give him something that shows like I'm the guy. Yeah. So I spent those couple weeks in preparation for this meeting, like compiling all this research and delving into, you know, the history of, you know, not only just the series. And I remember I made this whole like family tree, like a graphic, had every relative of the Strodes and the Myers and the, you know, all the way down the line. Oh, so I did that. And then I had kind of like done a synopsis of every movie that had come before and where it could go next without being very specific, you know, like it was kind of, you could do this and you could do that, all these different options.
Where were you going to take Halloween 3? Sorry, just kidding.
Well, I did have Halloween 3 in my Halloween 6 script. They just,
oh, that's awesome. Too. No, I mean, that's so, probably the one that's the most open-ended, right?
Right. Yeah. It's still kind of a cool movie. So in its own right,
yeah. Definitely. No disrespect. I love Halloween 3. It was just more like, it's so different than like the chronology of the others.
Well, but, yeah, that's what I mean. The whole idea of 3 tells you it's a continuation of 2. So that's, I think, was bad marketing on their part. But I think if they just call it Halloween Season of the Witch, people would have maybe thought, oh, okay, it's not, you know, part 3.
Or even just Season of the Witch. But anyway.
Right, right. Exactly. You're right. So I walk in, you know, and I'm ushered into the, it's just what you guys would think, you know, so you walk in and it's this big office on Sunset. And so, and I come in with my little notebook and I'm thinking I'm all prepared. And, you know, here comes this kid into the door. And it's literally what you think, like the Halloween posters all over the walls. And there's most of him with his big pipe, you know, behind his giant desk. So, I mean, I was like terrified. And I barely sit down and he asked me a couple of like, let's say more personal questions, you know, like where am I from and, you know, where I grew up. And I think it was just sort of like, who's this kid? You know, I mean, I'm sure I looked 19 at the time. So So I met with him and, you know, probably with handshaking, I offered him my little Bible of all things Halloween. And one of the things I had a friend of mine had done some graphics and I asked him to take the Halloween, you know, kind of logo and replace the A with the thorn triangle.
Oh yeah.
So I had that. And then it said 666 next to it. And he was really like, oh, okay, you know, and okay, nice to meet you. Goodbye. And I think he asked me a question where I like really sounded stupid and I can't remember what it was like. And he just kind of, I remember him kind of laughing, but that was like me not knowing his sense of humor. Cause I'm thinking, oh my God, I just made the biggest fool of myself in front of this man. So, you know, one of those things you play over in your head 100 times, like, oh my God, why did I say that?
Well,
and the meeting was that was it. It wasn't even 10 minutes. It was maybe 5.
How long after did they hire you?
5 years later, I get a call.
What?
Yeah.
I mean, I know because the movie didn't come out, but did they let you know, oh, hey, we're holding on this project? Or did you just, you just thought, oh, shit, it didn't work out?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, over those 5 years, you know, I was doing my day job and writing scripts. And I actually had one other little indie movie produced, which was really cool. You know, experience, I think I was 22 at that point. So, you know, I just felt like, okay, you know, and I just wasn't, you know, putting my energy into thinking I would ever get a call from producers of Halloween at that point. It just was not even in my consciousness. And then I remember the phone rang and it was him. And he's like, you know, we need you to come in because, and now I'm jumping in time here because now we're in early part of 1994. And I met him in 1989.
Oh my God. And they called you in and you were hired like that?
Well, no, like, no. I wish. No, it wasn't that easy. I got this call and he asked me to come in and I walked in, different office, same kind of setup in Century City. And it was Mustafa and it was Paul Freeman, who was the producer of 4, who was coming back to produce 6, and Malik Akkad, Mustafa's son. Mm-hmm. And it was the three of them and myself. And they basically sat me down and said, look, we've been through, I don't know if they said dozens, but many, many drafts, many, many writers. And the person that keeps coming back to their minds is me because of all of the, and then he has this thing that I brought 5 years ago. It's on his desk.
Wow.
That's flattering.
And he said, this has become like our, you know, our own kind of reference resource, because everything that we need to know, you know more about this than we do about the series. So it's very clear that you know what it's about and what, you know, so we're inviting you to give us something because we have nothing. this point, and we have to start shooting this movie this by the fall.
Oh,
so it was a bit of a like, oh my God, you know. And then I was on, you know, then you're on the spot. I'm like, shit, now I gotta. And I mean, I had some ideas swirling in my head, but it wasn't like a really worked out story. But the one thing I said to him, and I remembered that this is what got his attention. And I said, it's like Rosemary's Baby meets Halloween. And when I said that, he immediately understood tonally what I was gonna, you know, what I wanted to write.
Wow. No, that is such a great story. Yes. Like, really, and such, like, as fans ourselves, the idea that like a fan can become like the writer of one of these movies is just so inspiring. And just, it's such a, yeah, it's such a great story. But I,
and as long as we've known you, I don't think I've ever heard the story so detailed. And
I love hearing these details. I mean, and the thing is that I have, my next question is going to be probably an even bigger question, so we'll see how you answer. This is a big one, but this is something literally I've always really wanted to know for decades. Okay. So, you know, okay, so look, obviously
really dating me here.
I'm dating myself too.
I mean, Halloween 6 only came out like 3 years ago, right?
Exactly.
Oh yeah, of course. We're all in our 20s. No. Right. Okay, so look, so fans of the series know that Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers went through, you know, a ton of different rewrites and reshoots, etc. And then, you know, a vastly different cut of the film, the producer's cut, was released in 2014 with the box set, and so that was supposed to be closer to what your original script was, but I've heard that even that cut kind of veers far away from your original script for the film. So anyway, my question is, can you take us through what the plot of your original script was for Halloween 6? Like, I'm dying to know how you originally intended for the story to go and what happened to the various characters. Obviously, just a summary form, but like, because we've never gotten to see that original, what was the original story that you had?
All I can remember about it, guys, was it was just much bigger and more ambitious than what, you know, ultimately went into either of those versions. And they're two so tonally, story-wise, different versions of the movie. I mean, it certainly leaned closer to the producer's cut, as it's come to be called. I don't know why it's called that, but it is. I guess because the director created the theatrical mess. You know, it just was bigger, and I played more on the tricks and the games that Michael Myers plays with his victims. It was just lots more of that kind of stuff. Like, I mean, in terms of the plot, it was the same plot. It was, you know, Tommy Doyle, you know, being this kind of reclusive, weird, you know, very damaged guy watching the house across the street. And I always had at the beginning this idea, I wanted to go back to that notion of the two houses facing each other like the original film. But I thought also just kind of delving more into the backstory of, you know, I just remember one of the things that always occurred to me was like, well, Michael Myers was walking from that POV shot at the very beginning of the first movie from like across the street. So what was across the street? And that's where that whole notion of a little old lady came from, you know, Mrs. Blankenship. She was looking after him that night. All of that came out of just my recollection, crazy, bizarre knowledge of obsession with the original movie. Anyhow, but you know, I mean, it was always the plot was what sort of seen. It's just, it was missing all kinds of stuff. Like but suspense and buildup and terror. And
you're like all these things, like suspense.
Yeah, just like think that that's what you'd go for when you're making a Halloween movie. And it just didn't occur to me that people didn't see that. We were making different movies in our heads. You know, that's the problem with that movie, is that we all had a different idea of what it was supposed to be.
They should have had you direct it too.
I know, when people ask, and it's been asked to me a few times, like, what is the one thing you would change? And I said, you know what? Given the way he was so receptive to me, I should have pitched myself as a director. I just was so young. I don't think I had the confidence to think I could even do something like that, you know, at that time.
It's actually lesson nice. Learned. It's nice to hear until, again, that's something I didn't know until today either. I didn't know that it's at least good to hear that the main plot of your film, because I thought you were going to say, well, I started it in Los Angeles. That was vastly different.
The structure is what it is. It's just, it was also sort of cornball, you know, like when they got to that third act and they're all in these robes and it's like the Temple of fucking Doom. And I'm like, what is going on here? Like, remember, like what I said, what I pitched to most of it, and what we all agreed upon, we were trying to do kind of like a really kind of creepy thriller, you know, Rosemary's Baby vibe married to the Halloween mythology and the Halloween storyline. And so when I thought of those kind of ritual things, I was thinking of it as like Rosemary's Baby, where these were all people that you could just, you know, pass on the street. You know, it wasn't like some secret society, you know, Temple of Doom. I just thought of it, and also keeping it all very surreal, you know, like when we're in those moments. You guys remember that scene in Rosemary's Baby where she was impregnated by this, you know, devil or whatever it was.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was
it's hard to forget.
That to me is, to me, that's what all of that stuff was. That's how I wrote it. And that's what was in my head. It was much more surreal and nightmarish as opposed to being very literal. So it just, that's, I just remember being so confused when I was like, what, you know, what is, what is this? And it just was goofy. And I just remember being for a short period, I was a couple of weeks of the shoot out in Salt Lake City. I was invited to come and that was fun. Cause like I said, you know, the cast and we all got very close and we're all so young, you know, and so grateful to be a part of this. But I do remember one morning, I think I'd spent like an all nighter in my room, like rewriting pages and trying to, you know, make the script into something they could shoot when it started snowing. I do remember that.
Oh God.
Yeah, so we had a lot of things going against us, but I remember they were playing like some of the dailies in like the adjacent office, and it was the scene with the radio DJ and his body's in the tree, and I'm like, what is that? And they're like, well, that's the body in the tree that you wrote, and I'm like, I didn't write that. That looks like a mannequin. Like that looks horrible. Like what? That's like a test shot, right? And they're like, no, that's it. That's the scene. That's, I'm like, oh, my
mommy, God. It's raining red.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That whole mess. And that's not what it was. I never wrote that line. that being said, Mustafa wandered into the office at that moment and he's like, you know, this movie, because my script was just called like Halloween 666. It didn't have any other subtitle. And so he's like, turns to me and I'm printing pages and I'm kind of annoyed. And he's like, well, what should we call this? We, you know, we had the return and the revenge, like we needs another, you know, title. What's, and I said, well, given what I'm seeing, you just call it The Curse. And that's how it came.
Genius.
No, he actually thought it was a great title and then obviously stuck. But I mean, I said it out of frustration, you know, more like what the fuck is going, you know, like they're turning this in. It's like this movie's cursed.
Oh, wow. That's a great story too. That's amazing.
I remember the trailer for Halloween 666.
Yeah.
I was so excited.
They stuck like a thing that said the origin with that, which was never a title. Never, never, never. So I don't even know. That must have just come from Miramax and they were just pulling it out of their ass. I don't know.
That's too funny. One other plot device I do have to mention is obviously the character of Jamie. And we're not going to ask you about the whole Danielle Harris not reprising because you can watch the Blu-ray and she does the whole story, which I actually was very thankful that was in there because obviously every fan is like, why is she not Jamie? Mm-hmm. With that said, we love JC Brandy. We had her on the podcast. She was amazing.
She's awesome.
Yeah. But was there ever so? But my thoughts as someone who, you know, you get attached to these characters, was there ever a draft where did you always intend to kill off Jamie in the beginning or slash, you know, the middle? Meaning, was there ever a draft where she was going to be the main character or was it always going to be focused on Kara and Tommy Doyle?
Well, I'll tell you, when I first went into that meeting with Malik and his dad and Freeman, you know, I think in my opening, you know, salvo, I said, and Jamie Lloyd, and they're like, stop. No, Jamie Lloyd's. We don't want, it wasn't Mustafa. It was more like another producer. We don't want, you know, that's been played out. We don't, and I said, but, you know, it's a character that everybody, you know, and I'm like kind of delicate. I mean, I want this job, so I don't want to be fighting with the producers, but I kind of said, listen, what if we use her as kind of like the torch there at the beginning, and she's going to pass this torch, which was like literally like a baby in this movie. And I continued to pitch that idea, most of it was like, I get it. You should definitely do that. You should wrap up that story. And I said, well, you know, she's this heroic character. And so in the original, you guys were asking about the original script. What I do remember was she did not die at the beginning. She did not die at the middle, but she made it to the very end of the movie. And so when there's kind of like that big, you know, kind of it's the ritual and it's all the stuff that's happening. And as we come out of that sort of very sort of psychedelic kind of scene, Jamie was there to lead the other characters out of the catacombs under the hospital. Oh. And she was wounded. And I had her put up this huge fight with Michael, kind of like, I always likened it to that scene at the end of Escape from New York where like, where Adrienne Barbeau is like meeting.
Yes.
Like, at the end of the bridge. And yeah, she's just fire. It's like, I kind of wrote it that way. And it was, she was just waiting for him and she allowed them to save her son and to get, and she led them out through these tunnels because she knew how to get out of there. And she fended him off to the best of her ability and put up a hell of a fight. And he ends up winning and she dies, but I felt like she died much more heroic.
Why couldn't we have had that? Well, no, sounds great. Because
No. I mean, the producers are like, not Mustafa. He kind of was like, Dan knows this better than we do. You know, he always kind of deferred to me. But yeah, there were other producers, line producers on the movie. They were like, no.
We need to get rid of her soon and pass the torch.
Yep.
It frustrates me as a fan of this series and any series is that people get invested in these characters. They don't want to see them die. Or if they do die, it's got to be like you wrote, a true fan who knows this. So it just so frustrates me because that is a great idea. That's a great idea.
Well, I mean, it felt like it was like a payoff to what we saw at the beginning. You know, she's escaping at the beginning and these tunnels and all that. And then she helps the others survive, you know, and escape. You know, she shows them the way out. And I just thought that was a great kind of bookend to the beginning of the movie. But they were, oh hell no. She, you know. And then that's why we pulled it back to like in the cut that you guys have seen, the producer's cut, where she gets like, you know, shot in the head while she's in a dream in the middle of the hospital. I'm like, what is that? Like, it just like she just lies there and she doesn't. It's just terrible.
I know. It's like, I want to like it more because she lasts longer, but I'm like, is she really lasting longer? No, she's just like asleep.
Sleeping in the hospital and she just gets shot in the head. I mean, it's just kind of like, I don't know. And again, it needed to come down to her versus Michael, you know, like you needed to have that last hurrah, you know, like that last conflict between those two characters. And originally it was Danielle and that's the script she signed up for. That's what she came in. And in fact, when we went out and they posted the role, you know, just as an open audition, Danielle walked in and she goes, well, why are you doing an open audition? Here I am. Like, the director was like, well, we didn't know you'd want to do it. And she's like, duh. Yeah. So yeah, that's when Danielle talks about the changes in the script, that's what she's talking about. You know, the ending where she made it till the end of the movie, which was gratifying, you know, I think for her. And also I think for the, like us, you know, the fans that would want to see them go at it, you know, head to head one last time.
Yeah.
You know, and it was always conceived. I kind of had to give into the whole, like, Jamie dies, but I felt like in a way it was okay at that point. You know, she'd been through so much and, you know, and if she's going to live on through this child, then great. And as long as she fights her way out to the end, then it's satisfying.
Didn't want her thrown on a meat
on a farm tractor? on a tractor. I don't, again, like that's all reshot stuff. I wasn't there. I just remember going, this is just, and I remember Malik Akkad, just how disgusting, like what a horrible way to end that character. You know, like we weren't a part of any of that stuff.
I remember that was the first Halloween I saw in the theater because I'm a slight bit younger than Tim.
I saw it opening night and I was so happy Halloween was being made.
Well, me too, but I remember being like, well, first I remember when I first saw her on stage, I was like, wait, that's not Danielle Harris. And then my second thought was, did they just like brutally kill the star of two movies in the first like 10 movies, but well, like, 10 minutes. 10 God, why am I having trouble talking?
That also like how they killed Adrian King and Friday the 13th part 2?
Yeah.
It's not fair.
It's really disrespectful to fans because any production companies need to know this. Like, it's like, why would you do that to people who love characters in the movie and that love those final girls or final characters? But okay, we have one last Halloween six thing, a little game that we're going to do where we're going to just throw out some rapid fire questions. And without thinking too much, just give us the first answer that pops into your mind. Oh, like, for instance, and just a quick thing. So like, if I were to say Halloween H2O or Halloween 2018, you'd say
H2O.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay. Ready? If you had to just think, percentage of your original script that made it into the actual film.
57.
Favorite scene in the theatrical cut?
Oh my god, I have to remember it, you guys. Like, honestly, I think I blocked it out. it's like something that's not in the, in, I guess I just have to understand the question. So it's something that's not in the producer's cut. Is that right?
Yeah. Favorite scene okay. from the wide release.
I mean, I guess people like the thing where he's chopping up a bunch of doctors in an operating room. But again, I didn't write all of that. So I don't know. I guess it was like visually kind of cool, but I don't know. That's a bad answer. Sorry.
No, it's okay. There's no wrong answers. Easy okay. question. And I know the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Theatrical cut or producer's cut?
I mean, it's, you know, I mean, producer's cut with a giant asterisk, like that's still not script, you know.
Totally understand.
Yeah. Paul Rudd's portrayal of Tommy Doyle, creepier than you envisioned or just right?
Weirder than yes. I envisioned.
I agree with that. I always thought he was very weird in that. I didn't know if you envisioned him to be that way. Okay. Another kind of obvious question, but I want to hear it from the writer's mouth. Is Michael Myers actually the father of his niece, Jamie's baby?
No.
Wait, he isn't?
No, not in the script I wrote. He does. See this, I've been like accused of like creating like incest scenes for this script and this movie. Like it does. That's not what it was. You don't understand. Like she was in a drug-induced haze, and what she was being infected with, impregnated with, was the evil that was Michael, not he himself having sex with his niece. Like people don't understand that it's symbolic. It's not literal.
I did not know that. I thought all this time, because I was like, no, interesting and a little odd and uncomfortable, but hey, he must have had a reason for it. Okay, so they were impregnating her with like the evil. Okay, yes. Well, that makes me feel a little more comfortable.
Right.
Okay, now who's Danny Strode's father?
Good question. We talked about it, and there was one conversation where it was suggested that we'd reveal in the next movie that Wynn was his father. Like she'd had an affair with this like professor.
But that would make her bad, right?
No.
Yeah, I just think it's stupid. But that was brought up at some meeting. But I don't think we'd need to know who his father was.
Okay.
Drunk night out. Yeah, but yeah, like maybe a high school boyfriend that kind of jilted her. And, you know, I think she was just one of those kids that got, you know, talked into, you know, thinking that somebody loved her because her father certainly never showed that.
Yes.
Was there an initial script that had Danny killing his mother, Kyra?
Kara.
Ah!
I'm not sure who Kyra is.
Listen, Wiz Weiss.
Wiz? I was going to say Amanda Weiss.
Oh, people don't know the inside joke.
Let me clean that up really fast.
Oh, best thing ever, though.
Dan Farrens writes all these scary things, but I have seen him never laugh so hard.
I've never laughed that hard. No, I wasn't at you. I was laughing.
It's okay. I'm happy either way.
Wait, tell everybody okay. what he was laughing
so
at.
So I was interviewing, Dan, do you want to tell the story?
I don't know if I can, because I'll start laughing.
Okay.
He mispronounced Amanda Wiss's last name.
Yes. I was interviewing Tommy Hudson.
Yes.
I don't even know.
You are Hudson. And that's the reason I was laughing, because the look on his face. It wasn't you. It was laughing at Tommy, because he looked so like he didn't know what to do. He was like frozen, like a deer in the headlights. And was like,
I will set the scene for people, because I've watched this a thousand times and I love it too. I can't help but laughing. But Tim is interviewing the director of Amanda Wiss's new movie, The Id. It's Tommy Hudson. And he keeps mispronouncing Amanda Wiss's last name. And Tommy Hudson says, it's not Weiss, it's Wiss. And Tim's like, okay, got it. Introducing Amanda Wiss, it's Wiss. Okay, Amanda Wiss.
It's on YouTube.
You have to look. But
I was literally on the floor. Like you couldn't see me. Like I couldn't breathe. I was laughing.
I do this podcast with Tim every week, so I have a million mispronunciations. So I feel like I'm just used to it, but it's still that video is funny. But what was there an initial script where Danny Strode killed his mother, Kara?
Yes. Wait, ask me the question one more time.
I'm going to let Matt ask.
Was there an initial script that had Danny killing his mother, Kara Strode?
Oh, there is an initial script where Kara ends up bleeding to death on the floor. And we don't know who killed her, but we can assume it was the little kid, or it could have been Michael Myers. We don't know. I'll paint for you guys, if you want, if we have a second, I'll paint for you the last scene of what the original script was. All hell had broken loose at the mental institution at Smith's Grove, and you know, Loomis had survived barely, and sent the kids away. They end up at the same bus terminal where Jamie had been the night before with the baby and calling the radio show. And they end up at the same place. And Tommy goes to call the police, the same phone booth where Jamie had been the night before. Kara takes the kids down into that restroom area, if you remember from the movie.
Of course.
And as he's calling for help, he hears this, you know, blood-curdling scream. He runs down into the restroom and opens each one of the stall doors. The last one, there's Kara bleeding to death on the floor, their throat slit, and the children are gone. We hear sirens coming, and Tommy's going to get blamed for all of what's happened.
Ooh.
That was the end of it.
Dark, but very intriguing. Yeah. I like that. So, okay, because Danny was always the one they were trying to get to be like, kind of like,
almost right.
Like the next.
So it could have been him. It could have been Danny, and then he escaped the baby, but the children are just missing. And so that set the stage for Seven, which was going to be kind of like a road movie where Tommy is being hunted by Michael, by the police, by, you know, he was kind of like the hitcher, you know, kind of like a man running for his life. That was the setup for Seven.
And Jodie Lynn O'Keefe.
We were going to work Jamie Lee Curtis into it, but
yes, we were. Well, actually, that was a thing. She was going to appear at the end.
She was in your Halloween 7.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, now we got to
show up the very end.
You have to tell us, how were you going to work Laurie Strode back in?
There was going to be a scene very kind of like Wicker Man / the Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, where the whole town of Haddonfield is really involved in this dark conspiracy. And they offer one family per generation to keep the town safe. It's like you find out this whole kind of like dark kind of lore behind, you know, the holiday. And at the end, when they're, you know, when shit's hitting the fan and they're about to, you know, the whole town is kind of gathered for this like Samhain festival, Laurie Strode shows up and she takes Michael on. And she and then there was gonna be a version where she saved Jamie, because that was in the original treatment where Jamie never died. So first treatment, Jamie didn't die, so she saved her daughter of the seventh film.
So Jamie would have been in 6 and 7.
Yep. That was the idea. Yeah. So like I said, it became so kind of different along the way. That's why it's always like I have to put an asterisk when you guys ask me which.
No,
ones.
I know. Well, our final question on is if given the opportunity, and it sounds like you have a ton of ideas for it, would you continue the storyline and characters from Halloween 6 as like an alternate timeline for the series?
You know, it's interesting. Of course, you know, it would be fun to revisit all of that. I just don't know if there'd be an interest in it. Although now I say, with all of the different, you know, expanding universes of all these different franchises, I mean, that'd be kind of fun, you know, if you did it as a like a limited series or something, you know, where you're kind of taking these story threads that have been kind of out there in different sequels and different ideas of, you know, like Michael's early years at the sanitarium, or, you know, just all the different character threads that kind of have been woven through the series throughout the years, and just kind of bridge those out into their own like Mandalorian, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the truth is, Dan, is that like, I feel like before the last maybe decade, there was always pressure that every series had to connect, whether it was like, you know, in one sequence or it had to be connected. And now so many series between reboots and read this and read that and alternate timelines, I feel like, especially with obviously people are, you know, love Jamie Lee Curtis coming back, this new trilogy, but after Halloween ends, people are not going to want to be done with Michael Myers, and like there's still all these great stories and great characters that we just didn't get to see continue. So what I'm saying, Dan, is write your next version and we'll produce it.
Well, that's perfect. You know what? At least you guys would protect the vision. And that's what, you know, I think that's what it is. And I think the lesson learned is like, you know, these franchises, especially as they've gone on, even when we were, you know, I mean, at the time we thought there's going to be 6 of these movies. Like I couldn't even register that. But you know what? I think they're safer in the hands of people like, you know, the fans that get it, that want to preserve the intentions behind the original, but also building it in new, different and interesting ways. I mean, I think David Gordon Green's done a good job, I think, of like taking some of the more complicated things that have happened and kind of distilling it down into the essence of what, you know, Halloween was always intended to be.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I agree with his decision, though, about like taking the brother sister thing out. I honestly don't think that it helped anything, because it's still the story of Laurie versus Michael. And I felt like it gave that extra bit of gravitas to the whole thing.
So, I struggled with that when I first heard they were doing that. I had a real problem with that because I've just grown up. It's always been Michael and Laurie, brother and sister. And I actually liked that connection and that reason. I think I've warmed up to it purely because I just love Jamie Lee Curtis in these movies. And I'm like, I'll take her however, as long as she's Laurie Strode. Mm-hmm. With that said, you're right. If there's still Michael versus Laurie and they still have this connection and need to fight, like, why not make it one sister, you know? And now he's coming for the... And John Carpenter always says, oh, this was such a bad idea. She, you know, never should have written it. I'm like, I kind of think it's kind of cool.
I'm sorry. You know, I know he trashes Halloween too, but it's still the best sequel in my opinion.
Oh, do you see you see my shirt? I'm wearing a Halloween 2 shirt.
I was about to say that I hadn't the memorial. You know, to me, it's the one that captures the essence of the first one the closest.
I agree.
It's creepy and dark. And hey, she's back in the hospital in Halloween Kills, so they're doing Halloween 2 part 2.
Other than
2.1, maybe.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Tim, what were you saying?
Oh, I was just saying, other than the wig, I honestly feel like it continues really well.
I mean, it really does. It definitely isn't, it's not the original. I mean, with, you know, all those scenes and just pure suspense, like you were saying, you wanted for Halloween 6. And it's definitely not the original, but as a sequel, it was just dark and creepy and it still had that feel, you know?
I love the wig.
Tim actually owns that same wig.
I wear it every night.
I do want to switch gears, even though we could talk to you forever about Halloween 6 because we're such big fans. But I want people that are listening to know it's only because A, we're huge Halloween fans. B, we're good friends with Dan Farron. So I hope that you've at least enjoyed like just hearing kind of friends talk about like a big series. And actually, I only had A and B on that. So So your new film, Ted Bundy, American Boogeyman, which we just had the pleasure of seeing in the theater this past week. Now, this isn't the first time that you've written and directed a film based on a true crime story, since I know you've also done movies about Sharon Tate and Nicole Brown Simpson. So I guess what I'm wondering is, what led to this interest in true crime stories and doing movies based on actual events?
You know, I don't know that it became my interest as much as the interest of people who financed these films and saw what I had done with the Amityville murders several years ago, which was, again, based on a true crime, certainly adding in a sort of supernatural element to that, because how the fuck do you explain those murders? That makes no sense. And obviously the whole, you know, haunted house aspect of that story, and it always seems to, you know, come into it. But that being said, that was the beginning where I was being approached by, you know, these producers about, hey, we would like to do something about X, you know, and I would go away and I'd think about it. It's like, well, we can't just make a movie about the freaking Manson murders. It's so depressing. It's so awful. There's no redemption. But I'd always in the back of my mind wanted to do a movie, not necessarily that story, but about a story about how the victims of some terrible tragic crime are able to turn the tables on their killers and set it in a kind of spiritual dimension, a kind of purgatory, if you will. And that's what The Haunting of Sharon Tate was about for me. It was about these lost souls in a purgatory don't know that they're dead, and they're having to and kind of like, I guess Groundhog Day is kind of a cheap way of explaining it, but get that, of having to relive the moments leading up to the horrible ending. I think it's just one of those stories that is, in retrospect, is just too hot, even 50 years down the road. I think it's just something that people have a visceral, very, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Just a very
raw. I mean, raw, like, even it's weird to say raw about something that's that long ago. But I mean, it's kind of like the same things they said when people's tried doing movies about like 9/11. You know, it's
It's just a raw. It just hits a nerve, and I get it. I guess I didn't see the kind of personal attacks that were going to come, because I thought people hopefully will understand that this is a story of empowerment and redemption, not about let's have fun watching these poor people get murdered. There was never a thought in my head, and I can promise you that Hillary Duff's or anybody else's, that we were enjoying like depicting the murder of Sharon Tate and her friends. I mean, it is one of the most horrifying crimes of the 20th century. And, you know, if anything, we wanted to pay homage to her and those people and kind of take the power away from the evil and give it to them. And all of that just blew up in our faces. I think we just live in a time when everybody wants to hate on something and they want to do it very vocally. I mean, it resulted in like death threats.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, no, it was rough.
Well, so, we can shift away from the negative.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah, I was like, let's shift away from the negative and go right to Ted Bundy. Very positive. Well, no, but I am interested.
Yeah, you guys have seen the movie now. So
yes, now that we've seen the movie, mm-hmm. how much research did you do for this? Like, did you interview mm-hmm. the real life FBI agent Kathleen McChesney or any of the survivors of the Ted Bundy murders before writing a script?
I didn't. I kind of, again, one of those things where they wanted to remember, this was also the very beginning of the pandemic or slightly mm-hmm. before. And they had come to me with this idea and I was just kind of tossing it around in my head. And how do we, you know, go about this? But so that being said, though, the real Detective McChesney has seen the film and she had a lot of very complimentary things to say about it. Although the fact she said the one thing we got wrong is that she never drank coffee. No.
She's so, like, it was tea all the
way. It was always tea. Anyway, but no, she was very kind in her assessment of the film and the way that she felt that we were very respectful of the victims. And although we don't shy away from the brutality of what he did to these girls, I think one of the things that was important to me as the filmmaker going in was I wanted to keep saying their names, you know, through the lens of this detective character, McChesney, who is played by Holland Roden, who's a wonderful actress. And she really is the voice of those girls. And for me, the story needed to have that moral spine to it for it to connect. I didn't want to just make a horror movie about Ted Bundy. I wanted to make a movie that said Ted Bundy was a monster and these girls were his victims. And by rights, they should be here today. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the tragic part of the story. And even what happened with Bundy's mother, you know, played by the amazing Lynn Shay in his film. Mm-hmm. And just the world of denial that she lived in until the end. Like, you guys have seen the movie. I won't say what it was, but like those words that she says are actually what she said. So in my research, which was watching a lot of the documentaries, reading almost every book I could get my hands on, you know, that's where it took shape.
With all that research, how long did it take you to write the script?
Oh God, not long, Tim. It didn't give me much time. So maybe I think in total, like about 6 weeks.
Wow. Wait, I'm sorry. You cut out. Did you say 6 weeks?
6 weeks. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's one thing to write a fictional script, but I mean, a script that's at least based on true events, mm-hmm. you know, to do that type of research, well, right. You know, and having done, considering we were just talking about Halloween, which is not based on true events, and right. now we're talking about a movie based on Ted Bundy, do you find that it's easier or more difficult to work on movies based on real life crimes that you can actually research, or I guess tougher because they're such sensitive subjects like you were talking about?
Yeah, with other films. I mean, the sensitive part, of course, but in terms of like having, you know, it's the same thing. I mean, you still have to find like a filmic structure. It's like a three act structure. Things have to happen at certain points in the story for it to flow. So, you know, and I think, you know, some people just can't dismiss themselves between feature films, you know, narrative films and documentaries, you know, like you didn't do this and you didn't that. I was like, well, you know, Rose and Jack didn't go on the Titanic either. You know, I like there is always
they didn't.
What? They're real people.
I know. They are. Yes, they are.
But in our hearts, they are.
In our hearts, they
because my heart will go on.
They will, and our heart will go on. You stole my line anyway, but no, that's good. But no, really, I just, you know, my heart goes out to the people through it, but also those who have survived, you know, past it, and the family members who've had to live with this tragedy for so long, or these tragedies, I should say. So, you know, I mean, I've been called everything from, you know, an exploitation, you know, psychopath, deranged, whatever. You know, I just see it as a way of kind of shining light on a very on a chapter of the, you know, of this country's history that is very shameful. And I think by shining a light on it, it kind of reminds us that there is light and that hopefully we look after each other a little bit more. We take care of our neighbors and we take care of our friends and our families, and we're all in this together. And that's where I'm always coming from. It's not to exploit these victims. It's more to say, this was an act of evil. And I think, let's face it, guys, we're living in some pretty fucking evil times right now. And I just think when we look back, I think many people will be ashamed of their behaviors today. And you know what? And I hope that somebody in the future tells a story that exposes that for what it was and reminds us. I just think history is a thing that can repeat itself if we don't remind ourselves of sometimes very difficult things.
Yeah.
So
no, that's
and I certainly never did it to make money because I didn't make a whole lot of that.
So. You're like, I didn't.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, shifting gears just a pinch.
No, go ahead. Sorry. That all got dark and heavy. Sorry, guys.
No, it's fine. Chad Michael Murray takes on a very disturbing and demented role of Ted Bundy in the film. Mm-hmm. And what kind of direction did you give Chad about portraying this type of character?
Yeah, like what was his process to get into character? It's
no.
Because, yeah.
It's how pretty, can we relate to that?
Yeah, it's very chill. Right?
I cast Chad because I just think he was willing to go there. I mean, we had several, Zoom calls. Because I remember, we're the first independent movie to be greenlit the kind of middle of the pandemic last summer. Wow. So everything we did was, reinventing, kind of the wheel in a sense, just how to work. But Chad's process was kind of just being off to himself. I mean, he really... I think he would have even gone further with it if we had more time. I mean, the movie was shot in like 13 days.
How many?
13.
Oh my God.
Wait, 13 days?
Yes.
Wow.
13 days. Yes. Jesus.
Our short was 4 days.
We did a short film in 4 days. How the hell did you do a movie?
I wish I'd had that was made in 13 days. So we didn't have a lot of time to really, there was no rehearsal period or anything like that. But I think Chad on his own had done, because we were sort of sequestered, we could only work in these weird bubbles. So he would spend a lot of that time just kind of getting into that space. And I could always tell when he was coming in, Bundy's coming in, he comes.
But did he spend time working out?
Yeah. How? I'm sorry, but like we're a gay podcast and we're going to say he was in such great shape and he's almost 40. And how is it? Like, was he working out between scenes?
I didn't observe that, but I know his diet was very restricted. Like he had really leaned out because there's that point in the story where we learn that Bundy, and this is not like I'm giving anything away, it's like true facts of the case, that he had escaped from jail the second time and he had actually hoisted himself out of a light fixture, like in his jail cell. Yeah. So in order to fit through that little 12 by 12 hole, he shrunk himself down to like 140 pounds. So Chad didn't go to that extreme. He didn't do like, the Christian Bale thing, but he, in the time we had, he really leaned out. So I don't remember watching, seeing him work out, but then again, we didn't see much of anyone in between, setups and stuff. We were all.
Yeah. And you only had 13 days.
So yeah, I know.
We spoke about this when we saw the movie in the theater, but the film and it's perfect segue because we were just talking about Halloween, but the film had a lot of, subtle homages to, or at least I felt to Halloween because from Ted Bundy kicking open the door on Halloween night while holding a dead Bundy. Oh my God.
Ted Bundy?
I'm sorry, audience. I'm having some major, I
got it.
So comfortable with you that like I am stuttering.
You're fine.
Okay. Well, very reminiscent of that scene, of course, Michael Myers holding the dead body, kicks open the door, and then even just referring to him as the boogeyman. Mm-hmm. Were these ties to Halloween purposeful? And I'm just going to go out on a limb here. Were you trying to say that Ted Bundy was almost like kind of like a Michael Myers type of boogeyman to all of us?
Yeah, that's you nailed it. I mean, okay. Yes. I mean, certainly not drawing a specific parallel to Halloween, the movie, but it's interesting that Bundy's, most horrific rampage happened in, the early months of 1978 when Halloween was being created. So, I mean, it was all happening, kind of all this stuff was in the zeitgeist. And I wonder if John Carpenter and Deborah Hill in writing that might have, because he was all over the news at that time, that somehow he would have been, I don't know, it's a question that I would, if I run into John, I would certainly ask him, was there ever any, because again, that scene you're talking about, the girl he's carrying to the house, did murder that girl on Halloween night. That did happen. There were parallels. He was a boogeyman. He did say that he was invisible and he could walk through walls. I mean, that wasn't made up for the movie. He claimed that he was under the power of this thing he called the entity. And all of that was, and all that inner monologue you hear Chad doing, in his head as he's driving around in these dark, roadways in the middle of the night and all those kind of inner monologues that he does, those are all actual Bundy speeches. They're not.
Wow.
So every word he says are real Bundy, I'd call them quotes, but yeah, they all come from Ted's actual mouth.
You know, I found, I think the ending sequence of the film, you know, which was based on Ted Bundy's murder spree in the Chi Omega sorority house, was incredibly suspenseful and just terrifying. Mm-hmm. And what makes it even more chilling is that a lot of what you see in this sequence really did happen in terms of those murders and how brutal they were. But there is a part at the end where, you know, the FBI agent arrives to shoot at Bundy and kind of save the day. And I know, you know, that didn't actually happen. So I guess my question is to you, when you're writing and directing a movie that's based on true events like this, how do you decide what you should keep as accurate as possible to what really happened versus what to take creative liberties with for entertainment value?
So it's a good question. I guess I go with that old John Ford quote, which is, when the legend becomes reality, print the legend.
I've heard that.
it's an old quote from a great old director. One of John Carpenter's idols, actually, John Carpenter, all the Westerns. But, you know, listen, it's fiction based on fact, essentially, what these movies are. So you have to still, you know, I think to have not had a, an arc for the detective character, for her to just disappear halfway through the story, everybody would have been left like, what? Like Jamie Lloyd, like, where'd she go?
Like Jamie Lloyd. Wait, where'd she go? Why she look different?
Right. Why is she not there? Right. So, I mean, we had to follow through. You know, you just, as a storyteller, you need to tell a story that has a beginning, middle, and end. And it may not always mirror like 100% of the real events. But I would say a good, in this film, a good, you know, 80 to 90% of it is the way it went down. You know, I mean, we changed the order of a couple things, some names here and there. But you know, other than that scene that you mentioned, I think it's pretty much the way it really went down. And the sequence of events, the date cards that you see all over the movie are the specific dates when all of those things happen.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So, I mean, I didn't know. I know a lot about Ted Bundy. I didn't know about the murder on Halloween night, which you just hear more and more.
Her name was, her name was Laura A. You know, she was this young girl who had gone out with some friends and she decided to walk by herself to go get cigarettes. And she never, you know, he came. And so we don't, you know, whatever really happened there, we don't know. But yeah, that was his victim on Halloween in Utah.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I want to also give you a chance to plug, because I know, or I read that there's another movie that you wrote and directed called Eileen Wuornos, American Boogie Woman, which is coming to theater. Now, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it should be released in theaters on September 20th with a video on demand and DVD release date of October 8th. Is that correct?
Sounds about right. I know September 20th is correct. The VOD, I'm not sure if it's, you guys probably know better than I do. But yeah, no, for sure. That's coming out September 20th. We'll have a one night kind of Fathom release, like what we did with the Ted Bundy film. And it's just kind of more of a promotional thing. Like today, given the climate we're in, unfortunately, you know, films are, you know, really, I mean, even major studio films are, you know, becoming more streaming releases. But, you know, it was great that Fathom saw in these films something that they would like to promote, and they kind of got behind them. So they're like, well, yeah, well, let's give it a little run. So American Boogie Woman, which is a bizarre title, was pitched to me again. Like they were like, let's do Boogie Woman. I said, well, what's the next one? Boogie Baby?
Boogie Nights.
Boogie Nights, yes. So Peyton List, who's a bright, wonderful young actress.
Love her in Cobra Kai.
So great. And so I think people are going to be surprised by this. I mean, you know, everybody is, if you remember about 15, 16 years ago now with Charlize Theron's a brilliant portrayal Monster. Of Eileen Wuornos in Monster. You know, I just want people knowing, if people are listening to this and as we continue to, you know, promote the movie, it is not Monster. It's not attempting to be Monster. It's telling a story of Eileen's life that very few people know, that when she was in her very early 20s, had hitchhiked down to Florida and met and married a much, much, much older man, very wealthy, high society of the land of Florida. And she, for a very brief period of time, Eileen lived the good life. And yet she couldn't escape her upbringing and the sort of torturous past that she had already, this path that she'd already kind of set in motion for herself in her life. And so our movie kind of posits what that marriage and that brief period of time might've been, but seen through the lens of Eileen's kind of fractured mind. So it's a kind of a what if movie. It's not at all trying to retell the story that we have seen in Monster. She hasn't yet become that monster.
Interesting. Well, cool. Yeah. I mean, definitely people look out for it, that it's coming out. Well, it'll be in theaters one day, September 20th. Uh-huh. And I think on demand, October 8th. And we have one final question for you, Dan. We asked this to everyone we interview, okay. And it's going to put you on the spot, but that's what we do. So since the Ted Bundy movie just came out, we can't ask about this, so I'm going to bring it back to Halloween 6. So what is one thing that you can tell us about your experience working on Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers, that you've never told any other interviewer, publication, podcast, or convention? One thing, it can be small, it can be big, that you've never told anyone else.
My God, guys, that is putting me on the spot, because I'm such an open book. I feel like I've said it all.
You'd be surprised some of the things we've heard after asking this question. And
well, I'm trying to think of Marianne. Like, Marianne and I were friends on that set. And I mean, if there was trouble to be had, we probably caused it. Paul Rudd is a terrible pool player.
Is a terrible what player?
Pool player.
But
I'm a terrible. I'm not criticizing, because we're all terrible. But he was like particularly bad.
That's hilarious. I'm a terrible pool player also. But you know, it's funny. We've spoken with Marianne. Her interview is going to be coming out in October. We're saving for like a little Halloween thing. And she had nothing but amazing things to say about you. She really did.
You know, she and I think were maybe the closest on that set of like anybody. Honestly, I think we were that like brother sister bond that. Just, you know, I haven't seen her in many years now, but I just like, we always are cheering each other on, even if it's from afar. And she's just somebody that I love and admire. And she's
loves you, yeah. And we love you. We love her. Oh. There's just a big love fest here. Yeah. But
well, you know what? Good, because the world needs more of that stuff.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly. Well, we just want to thank you seriously from the bottom of our little fan geek hearts.
well, I'm right with you. I'm as fan and much of a fanboy and a geek as you guys. So.
Well, yes, and that. But again, like you said, those, I think we're learning slowly that those are the people that should be working on these movies, because they really truly know them and love them. And so, thank you so much for taking the time just to go through all this. This was so much fun. I really learned a ton. Thank you.
You know, Matt's a Halloween fan.
I mean, yeah,
I've never known that before. I don't know why it is. I just never put two and two together, Matt. No, I'm just kidding.
I know. It's not like I all talk about it all the time on my every social media channel. No, but it is. It's seriously, it's like an honor to be able to talk with you about all this stuff. And
you too, anytime. And, you know, and I remember like you had a, like when you moved to New York for a brief period and you had a little going away, I came to that and I brought you something.
You brought me, I think it was it, you signed a...
Was it a DVD or was it, what was it?
It was either a DVD or a picture. I have it.
I
have all my like Halloween. It's like a scrapbook.
Of course.
Kind of stuff.
I'm sure.
Like,
so I just knew that it was, because at the time we didn't think we were coming back. So I was like, well, I'm going to go and I'm going to give him something. He'll definitely remember me.
I remember that. And you were very, very sweet. And you've always been a good friend to us. And I know to Tim and to everything. So thank you so much for letting us interview you. And we wish you the best of luck with the Boogie People duo. Boogeyman, Boogeywoman.
If we made a third one, it'd be easier. We just call it the Boogie Trilogy. But I don't know.
I know. If you could call it, I wish you luck with the Boogie Trilogy. I know. I don't know what to call it, just a duo. The Boogie Duo.
Duology, I don't know.
The duology of Boogie. Anyway.
You're a Boogie.
Okay, well, have a great evening, and we will talk with you soon.
Safe. Take care.
Okay, take care. Bye. Bye.
Bye. Bye, Tim.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Happy Horror Time. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, and through our website, happyhorrortime.com.
If you haven't already, please like and follow Happy Horror Time page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Happy Horror Time.
We love hearing from our listeners, so if you want to contact us, send us an email at happyhorrortime@gmail.com. You can tell us what you like about the podcast, give us movie recommendations, interview suggestions, or dating advice for Tim.
Oh, man. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit patreon.com/happyhorrortime to sign up. Patrons get access to our growing library of bonus episodes, where we look back at old horror films, popular franchises, and other fun stuff.
I'm Matt Emmert.
And I'm Tim Murdoch.
And we hope you've had a happy horror time.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.